16. Jake quickly descended into a foggy world where the only landmarks were pain, his throbbing hand, the place on his upper arm where Gasher's fingers dug in like steel pegs, his burning lungs. Before they had gone far, these pains were first joined and then overmatched by a deep burning stitch in his left side. He wondered if Roland was following after them yet. He also wondered how long Oi would be able to live in this world which was so unlike the plains and forest which were all he had known until now. Then Gasher clouted him across the face, bloodying his nose, and thought was lost in a red wash of pain.
"Come on here, little bastard, move your sweet cheeks!"
"Running as fast as I can," Jake gasped,
and just managed to dodge a thick shard of glass which jutted like a long, transparent tooth from the wall of junk to his left.
"You better not be, because I'll knock your cold and drag you along by the hair of your head if you are. Now hop, you little bastard!"
Jake somehow forced himself to run faster. He'd gone into the alley with the idea that they must shortly re-emerge onto the avenue, but he now reluctantly realized that wasn't going to happen. This was more than an alley. It was a camouflaged and fortified road leading ever deeper into the country of the Greys. The tall, tottery walls which pressed in on them had been built from an exotic array of materials, cars which had been partially or completely flattened by the chunks of granite and steel placed on top of them, marble pillars, unknown factory machines which were dull red with rust wherever they weren't still black with grease, a chrome and crystal fish as big as a private plane with one cryptic word of the high speech, delight, carefully incised into its scaly, gleaming side, crisscrossing chains, each link as big as Jake's head, wrapped around mad jumbles of furniture that appeared to balance above them as precariously as circus elephants do on their tiny steel platforms. They came to a place where this lunatic path branched, and Gasher chose the left fork without hesitation. A little further along, three more alleyways, these so narrow they were almost tunnels, spoked off in various directions. This time Gasher chose the right-hand branching. The new path, which seemed to be formed by banks of rotting boxes and huge blocks of old paper, paper that might once have been books or magazines, was too narrow for them to run in side by side. Gasher shoved Jake into the lead and began beating him relentlessly on the back to make him go faster. "This is how a steer must feel when it's driven down the chute to the slaughtering pen," Jake thought, and vowed that if he got out of this alive, he would never eat steak again.
"Run, my sweet little boy cunt, run!"
Jake soon lost all track of the twistings and turnings they made, and as Gasher drove him deeper and deeper into this jumble of torn steel, broken furniture, and cast-off machinery, he began to give up hope of rescue. Not even Roland would be able to find him now. If the gunslinger tried, he would become lost himself and wander the choked paths of this nightmare world until he died. Now they were going downhill, and the walls of tightly packed paper had given way to ramparts of filing cabinets, jumbles of adding machines, and piles of computer gear. It was like running through some nightmarish Radio Shack warehouse. For almost a full minute, the wall flowing past on Jake's left appeared to be constructed solely of either TV sets or carelessly stacked video display terminals. They stared at him like the glazed eyes of dead men. And as the pavement beneath their feet continued to descend, Jake realized that they were in a tunnel. The strip of cloudy sky overhead narrowed to a band, the band narrowed to a ribbon, and the ribbon became a thread. They were in a gloomy netherworld, scurrying like rats through a gigantic trash midden. "What if it all comes down on us?" Jake wondered. But in his current state of aching exhaustion, this possibility did not frighten him much. If the roof fell in, he would at least be able to rest. Gasher drove him as a farmer would a mule, striking his left shoulder to indicate a left turn and his right to indicate a right turn. When the course was straight on, he thumped Jake on the back of the head. Jake tried to dodge a jutting pipe and didn't quite succeed. It whacked into one hip and sent him flailing across the narrow passage toward a snarl of glass and jagged boards. Gasher caught him and shoved him forward again.
"Run, you clumsy squint! Can't you run? If it wasn't for the tick-tock man, I'd bugger you right here and cut your throat while I did it. Ah, so I would."
Jake ran in a red daze where there was only pain and the frequent thud of Gasher's fists coming down on his shoulders or the back of his head. At last, when he was sure he could run no longer, Gasher grabbed him by the neck and yanked him to a stop so fiercely that Jake crashed into him with a strangled squawk.
"Here's a tricky little bit," Gasher panted jovially. "Look straight ahead and you'll see two wires what cross in an X low to the ground. Do you see 'em?"
At first, Jake didn't. It was very gloomy here. Heaps of huge copper kettles were piled up to the left, and to the right were stacks of steel tanks that looked like scuba diving gear. Jake thought he could turn these latter into an avalanche with one strong breath. He swiped his forearm across his eyes, brushing away tangles of hair, and tried not to think about how he'd look with about 16 tons of those tanks piled on top of him. He squinted in the direction Gasher was pointing. Yes, he could make out, barely, two thin silvery lines that looked like guitar or banjo strings. They came down from opposite sides of the passageway and crossed about 2 feet above the pavement.
"Crawl under, dear heart. And be ever so careful, for if you so much as twang one of those wires, half the steel and cement puke in the city'll come down on your dear little head. Mine, too, although I doubt if that'd disturb you much, would it? Now crawl."
Jake shrugged out of his pack, lay down, and pushed it through the gap ahead of him. And as he eased his way under the thin, taut wires, he discovered that he wanted to live a little longer after all. It seemed that he could actually feel all those tons of carefully balanced junk waiting to come down on him. "These wires are probably holding a couple of carefully chosen keystones in place," he thought. "If one of them breaks, ashes, ashes, we all fall down." His back brushed one of the wires, and high overhead something creaked.
"Careful, Collie," Gasher almost moaned. "Be also careful."
Jake pushed himself beneath the crisscrossing wires using his feet and his elbows. His stinking, sweat-clogged hair fell in his eyes again, but he did not dare brush it away.
"You're clear," Gasher grunted at last, and slipped beneath the trip wires himself with the ease of long practice.
He stood up and snatched Jake's pack before Jake could reshoulder it.
"What's in here, Collie?"
he asked, undoing the straps and peering in.
"Got any treats for your old pal? For the Gasher man loves his treaties, so he does."
"There's nothing in there," but Gasher's hand flashed out and rocked Jake's head back with a hard slap that sent a fresh spray of bloody froth flying from the boy's nose.
"What did you do that for?" Jake cried, hurt and outraged. "For telling me what my own beshitted eyes can see," Gasher yelled, and cast Jake's pack aside.
He bared his remaining teeth at the boy in a dangerous, terrible grin.
"And for almost bringing the whole beshitted works down on us!"
He paused, then added in a quieter voice,
"And because I felt like it, I must admit that. Your stupid sheep's face puts me very much in a slapping temper, so it does."
The grin widened, revealing his oozing, whitish gums, a sight Jake could have done without.
"If your hard-case friend follows us this far, he'll have a surprise when he runs into those wires, won't he?"
Gasher looked up, still grinning.
"There's a city bus balanced up there someplace, as I remember."
Jake began to weep, tired, hopeless tears that cut through the dirt on his cheeks in narrow channels. Gasher raised an open, threatening hand.
"Get moving, Cully, before I start crying myself. For a wary, sentimental feller is your old pal, so he is. And when he starts to grieve and mourn, a little slapping is the only thing to put a smile on his face again. Run!"
They ran. Gasher chose pathways leading deeper into the smelly, creaking maze, seemingly at random, indicating his choices with hard wax to the shoulders. At some point, the sound of the drums began. It seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere, and for Jake, it was the final straw. He gave up hope and thought alike, and allowed himself to descend wholly into the nightmare. 17. Roland halted in front of the barricade, which choked the street from side to side and top to bottom. Unlike Jake, he had no hopes of emerging into the open on the other side. The buildings lying east of this point would be sentry-occupied islands emerging from an inland sea of trash, tools, artifacts, and booby traps, he had no doubt. Some of these leavings undoubtedly still remained where they had fallen 500 or 700 or 1,000 years ago, but Roland thought most of it had been dragged here by the Greys a piece at a time. The eastern portion of Ludd had become, in effect, the castle of the Greys, and Roland was now standing outside its wall. He walked forward slowly and saw the mouth of a passageway half hidden behind a ragged cement boulder. There were footprints in the powdery dust, two sets, one big, one small. Roland started to get up, looked again, and squatted on his hunkers once more. Not two sets, but three, the third marking the paws of a small animal. "Oi!" Roland called softly. For a moment there was no response, and then a single soft bark came from the shadows. Roland stepped into the passageway and saw gold-ringed eyes peering at him from around the first crooked corner. Roland trotted down to the bumbler. Oi, who still didn't like to come really close to anyone but Jake, backed up a step and then held his ground, looking anxiously up at the gunslinger. "Do you want to help me?" Roland asked. He could feel the dry, red curtain that was battle fever at the edge of his consciousness, but this was not the time for it. The time would come, but for now he must not allow himself that inexpressible relief. "Help me find Jake?" "Jake!" Oi barked, still watching Roland with his anxious eyes. "Go on, then. Find him." Oi turned away at once and ran rapidly down the alley, nose skimming the ground. Roland followed, his eyes only occasionally flicking up to glance at Oi. Mostly he kept his gaze fixed on the ancient pavement, looking for sign. XVIII. "Jesus," Eddie said. "What kind of people are these guys?" They had followed the avenue at the base of the ramp for a couple of blocks, had seen the barricade, missing Roland's entry into the partially hidden passageway by less than a minute, which lay ahead, and had turned north onto a broad thoroughfare which reminded Eddie of Fifth Avenue. He hadn't dared to tell Susanna that. He was still too bitterly disappointed with this stinking, littered ruin of a city to articulate anything hopeful. Fifth Avenue led them into an area of large white stone buildings that reminded Eddie of the way Rome looked in the gladiator movies he'd watched on TV as a kid. They were austere and, for the most part, still in good shape. He was pretty sure they had been public buildings of some sort, galleries, libraries, maybe museums. One with a big domed roof that had cracked like a granite egg might have been an observatory. Although Eddie had read someplace that astronomers like to be away from big cities, because all the electric lights fucked up their stargazing. There were open areas between these imposing edifices, and although the grass and flowers which had once grown there had been choked off by weeds and tangles of underbrush, the area still had a stately feel, and Eddie wondered if it had once been the center of Ludd's cultural life. Those days were long gone, of course. Eddie doubted if Gasher and his pals were very interested in ballet or chamber music. He and Susanna had come to a major intersection from which four more broad avenues radiated outward like spokes on a wheel. At the hub of the wheel was a large paved square. Ringing it were loudspeakers on 40-foot steel posts. In the center of the square was a pedestal with the remains of a statue upon it, a mighty copper warhorse, green with verdigris, pawing its forelegs at the air. The warrior who had once ridden this charger lay off to the side on one corroded shoulder, waving what looked like a machine gun in one hand and a sword in the other. His legs were still bowed around the shape of the horse he had once ridden, but his boots remained welded to the sides of his metal mount. "Gray's Die" was written across the pedestal in fading orange letters. Glancing down the radiating streets, Eddie saw more of the speaker poles. A few had fallen over, but most still stood, and each of these had been festooned with a grisly garland of corpses. As a result, the square into which Fifth Avenue emptied and the streets which led away were guarded by a small army of the dead. "What kind of people are they?" Eddie asked again. He didn't expect an answer, and Susanna didn't give one. But she could have. She'd had insights into the past of Roland's world before, but never one as clear and sure as this. All of her earlier insights, like those which had come to her in River Crossing, had had a haunting, visionary quality, like dreams. But what came now arrived in a single flash, and it was like seeing the twisted face of a dangerous maniac illuminated by a stroke of lightning. The speakers, the hanging bodies, the drums. She suddenly understood how they went together, as clearly as she had understood that the heavy-laden wagons passing through River Crossing on their way to Jimtown had been pulled by oxen rather than mules or horses.
"Never mind this trash," she said,
and her voice only quivered a little.
"It's a train we want. Which way is it, do you think?"
Eddie glanced up at the darkening sky and easily picked out the path of the beam in the rushing clouds. He looked back down and wasn't much surprised to see that the entrance to the street corresponding most closely to the path of the beam was guarded by a large stone turtle. Its reptilian head peered out from beneath the granite lip of its shell. Its deep-set eyes seemed to stare curiously at them. Eddie nodded toward it and managed a small, dry smile. "See the turtle of enormous girth?" Susanna took a brief look of her own and nodded. He pushed her across the city square and into the street of the turtle. The corpses which lined it gave off a dry, cinnamony smell that made Eddie's stomach clench. Not because it was bad, but because it was actually rather pleasant. The sugar-spicy aroma of something a kid would enjoy shaking onto his morning toast. The street of the turtle was mercifully broad, and most of the corpses hanging from the speaker poles were little more than mummies, but Susanna saw a few which were relatively fresh, with flies still crawling busily across the blackening skin of their swollen faces and maggots still squirming out of their decaying eyes. And below each speaker was a little drift of bones.
"There must be thousands," Eddie said. "Men, women, and kids."
"Yes." Susanna's calm voice sounded distant and strange to her own ears.
"They've had a lot of time to kill, and they've used it to kill each other."
"Bring on those wise fucking elves," Eddie said, and the laugh that followed sounded suspiciously like a sob.
He thought he was at last beginning to fully understand what that innocuous phrase, "the world has moved on," really meant. What a breadth of ignorance and evil it covered. And what a depth.
"The speakers were a wartime measure," Susanna thought. "Of course they were. God only knows which war or how long ago, but it must have been a doozy. The rulers of Lud used the speakers to make city-wide announcements from some central bomb-proof location, a bunker, like the one Hitler and his high command retreated to at the end of World War II.
And in her ears she could hear the voice of authority which had come rolling out of those speakers, could hear it as clearly as she had heard the creak of the wagons passing through River Crossing, as clearly as she had heard the crack of the whip above the backs of the straining oxen. "Ration centers A and D will be closed today. Please proceed to centers B, C, E, and F with proper coupons. Militia squads 9, 10, and 12 report to send side. Aerial bombardment is likely between the hours of 8 and 10 of the clock. All non-combatant residents should report to their designated shelters. Bring your gas masks. Repeat, bring your gas masks."
Announcements, yes. And some garbled version of the news. A propagandized, militant version George Orwell would have called doublespeak.
And in between the news bulletins and the announcements, squalling military music, and exhortations to respect the fallen by sending more men and women into the red throat of the abattoir. Then the war had ended, and silence had fallen for a while. But at some point, the speakers had begun broadcasting again. How long ago? 100 years? 50? Did it matter? Susanna thought not. What mattered was that when the speakers were reactivated, the only thing they broadcast was a single tape loop, the loop with the drum track on it. And the descendants of the city's original residents had taken it for... what? The voice of the turtle? The will of the beam? Susanna found herself remembering the time she had asked her father, a quiet but deeply cynical man, if he believed there was a God in heaven who guided the course of human events.
"Well," he had said, "I think it's sort of half and half, Odetta. I'm sure there's a God, but I don't think he has much, if anything, to do with us these days. I believe that after we killed his son, he finally got it through his head that there wasn't nothing to be done with the sons of Adam or the daughters of Eve, and he washed his hands of us. Wise fella."
She had responded to this, which she had fully expected. She was 11 at the time, and knew the turn of her father's mind quite well, by showing him a squib on the community church's page of the local newspaper. It said that Reverend Murdoch of the Grace Methodist Church would that Sunday elucidate on the topic, "God speaks to each of us every day," with a text from 1 Corinthians. Her father had laughed over that so hard that tears had squirted from the corners of his eyes.
"Well, I guess each of us hears someone talking," he had said at last. "And you can bet your bottom dollar on one thing, sweetie. Each of us, including this here Reverend Murdoch, hears that voice say just exactly what he wants to hear. It's so convenient that way."
What these people had apparently wanted to hear in the recorded drum track was an invitation to commit ritual murder. And now, when the drums began to throb through these hundreds or thousands of speakers, a hammering backbeat which was only the percussion to a ZZ Top song called Velcro Fly, if Eddie was right, it became their signal to unlimber the hang ropes and run a few folks up the nearest speaker posts.
"How many?" she wondered, as Eddie rolled her along in her wheelchair, its nicked and dented hard rubber tires crackling over broken glass and whispering through drifts of discarded paper. "How many have been killed over the years because some electronic circuit under the city got the hiccups? Did it start because they recognized the essential alienness of the music, which came somehow, like us and the airplane and some of the cars along these streets, from another world?" She didn't know, but she knew she had come around to her father's cynical point of view on the subject of God and the chats he might or might not have with the sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve. These people had been looking for a reason to slaughter each other, that was all, and the drums had been as good a reason as any. She found herself thinking of the hive they had found, the misshapen hive of white bees whose honey would have poisoned them if they had been foolish enough to eat of it. Here, on this side of the send, was another dying hive, more mutated white bees, whose sting would be no less deadly for their confusion, loss, and perplexity. "And how many more will have to die before the tape finally breaks?" As if her thoughts had caused it to happen, the speakers suddenly began to transmit the relentless, syncopated heartbeat of the drums. Eddie yelled in surprise. Susanna screamed and clapped both hands to her ears. But before she did, she could faintly hear the rest of the music. The track or tracks which had been muted decades ago when someone, probably quite by accident, had bumped the balance control, knocking it all the way to one side and burying both the guitars and the vocal. Eddie continued to push her along the street of the turtle and the path of the beam, trying to look in all directions at once and trying not to smell the odor of putrefaction. "Thank God for the wind," he thought. He began to push the wheelchair faster, scanning the weedy gaps between the big white buildings for the graceful sweep of an overhead monorail track. He wanted to get out of this endless aisle of the dead. As he took yet another deep breath of that speciously sweet cinnamon smell, it seemed to him that he had never wanted anything so badly in his whole life. 19. Jake's daze was broken abruptly when Gasher grabbed him by the collar and yanked with all the force of a cruel rider breaking a galloping horse. He stuck one leg out at the same time, and Jake went crashing backward over it. His head connected with the pavement, and for a moment all the lights went out. Gasher, no humanitarian, brought him around quickly by seizing Jake's lower lip and yanking it upward and outward. Jake screamed and bolted to a sitting position, striking out blindly with his fists. Gasher dodged the blows easily, hooked his other hand into Jake's armpit, and yanked him to his feet. Jake stood there, rocking drunkenly back and forth. He was beyond protest now, almost beyond understanding. All he knew for sure was that every muscle in his body felt sprung, and his wounded hand was howling like an animal caught in a trap.
Gasher apparently needed a breather, and this time he was slower getting his wind back. He stood bent over with his hands planted on the knees of his green trousers, panting in fast little whistling breaths. His yellow headscarf had slipped askew. His good eye glittered like a trumpery diamond. The white silk eye patch was now wrinkled, and curds of evil-looking yellow muck oozed onto his cheek from beneath it.
"Take a look over your head, Kelly, and you'll see why I brung you up short. Get an eyeful."
Jake tilted his head upward, and in the depths of his shock he was not at all surprised to see a marble fountain as big as a house trailer dangling 80 feet above them. He and Gasher were almost below it. The fountain was held suspended by two rusty cables, which were mostly hidden within huge, unsteady stacks of church pews. Even in his less than acute state, Jake saw that these cables were more seriously frayed than the remaining hangers on the bridge had been.
"See it?"
Gasher asked, grinning. He raised his left hand to his covered eye, scooped a mass of the pussy material from beneath it, and flicked it indifferently aside.
"Beauty, ain't it? Oh, the TikTok man's a trig cove, all right, no mistake. Where's those goat-fucking drums? They should have started by now. If Copperhead's forgotten my ram a stick so far up his arse, he'll taste bark. Now, look ahead of you, my delicious little squint."
Jake did, and Gasher immediately clouted him so hard that he staggered backward and almost fell.
"Not across, idiot child. Down. See them two dark cobblestones?"
After a moment, Jake did. He nodded apathetically.
"You don't want to step on him. For that, it'd bring the whole works down on your head, Cully, and anybody who wanted you after that, he'd have to pick you up with a blotter. Understand?"
Jake nodded again.
"Good."
Gasher took a final deep breath and slapped Jake's shoulder.
"Go on, then. What you waiting for? Up!"
Jake stepped over the first of the discolored stones and saw it wasn't really a cobblestone at all, but a metal plate which had been rounded to look like one. The second was just ahead of it, cunningly placed so that if an unaware intruder happened to miss the first one, he or she would almost certainly step on the second.
"Go ahead and do it, then," he thought. "Why not? The gunslinger's never going to find you in this maze, so go ahead and bring it down. It's got to be cleaner than what Gasher and his friends have got planned for you. Quicker, too."
His dusty moccasin wavered in the air above the booby trap. Gasher hit him with a fist in the middle of the back, but not hard.
"Thinking about taking a ride on the Handsome, are you, my little cow?" he asked.
The laughing cruelty in his voice had been replaced by simple curiosity. If it was tinged with any other emotion, it wasn't fear, but amusement.
"Well, go ahead, if that's what you mean to do, for I have my ticket already. Only be quick about it, God's blast your eyes."
Jake's foot came down beyond the trigger of the booby trap. His decision to live a little longer was not based on any hope that Roland would find him. It was just that this was what Roland would do. Go on until someone made him stop, and then a few yards farther still if he could. If he did it now, he could take Gasher with him, but Gasher alone wasn't sufficient. One look was enough to make it clear that he was telling the truth when he said he was dying already. If he went on, he might have a chance to take some of the Gasher man's friends, too, maybe even the one he called the TikTok man. "If I'm going to ride what he calls the Handsome," Jake thought, "I'd just as soon go with plenty of company." Roland would have understood. 20. Jake was wrong in his assessment of the gunslinger's ability to follow their path through the maze. Jake's pack was only the most obvious bit of sign they left behind them. But Roland quickly realized he did not have to pause to look for sign. He only had to follow Oi. He paused at several intersecting passages nevertheless, wanting to make sure. And each time he did, Oi looked back and uttered his low, impatient bark that seemed to say, "Hurry up, do you want to lose them?" After the signs he saw, a track, a thread from Jake's shirt, a scrap of bright yellow cloth from Gasher's scarf, had three times confirmed the bumbler's choices, Roland simply followed Oi. He did not give up looking for sign, but he quit making stops to hunt for it. Then the drums started up, and it was the drums, plus Gasher's nosiness about what Jake might be carrying, that saved Roland's life that afternoon. He skidded to a halt in his dusty boots, and his gun was in his hand before he realized what the sound was. When he did realize, he dropped the revolver back into its holster with an impatient grunt. He was about to go on again when his eye happened first on Jake's pack, and then on a pair of faint, gleaming streaks in midair just to the left of it. Roland narrowed his eyes and made out two thin wires which crisscrossed at knee level not 3 feet in front of him. Oi, who was built low to the ground, had scurried neatly through the inverted V formed by the wires, but if not for the drums and spotting Jake's cast-off pack, Roland would have run right into them. As his eyes moved upward, tracing the not-quite-random piles of junk poised on either side of the passageway at this point, Roland's mouth tightened. It had been a close call, and only Kaa had saved him. Oi barked impatiently. Roland dropped to his belly and crawled beneath the wires, moving slowly and carefully. He was bigger than either Jake or Gasher, and he realized a really big man wouldn't be able to get under here at all without triggering the carefully prepared avalanche. The drums pumped and thumped in his ears. "I wonder if they've all gone mad," he thought. "If I had to listen to that every day, I think I would have." He got to the far side of the wires, picked up the pack, and looked inside. Jake's books and a few items of clothing were still in there. So were the treasures he had picked up along the way, a rock which gleamed with yellow flecks that looked like gold but weren't, an arrowhead, probably the leaving of the old forest folk, which Jake had found in a grove of trees the day after his drawing, some coins from his own world, his father's sunglasses, a few other things which only a boy not yet in his teens could really love and understand. Things he would want back again. If, that was, Roland got to him before Gasher and his friends could change him, hurt him in ways that would cause him to lose interest in the innocent pursuits and curiosities of pre-adolescent boyhood. Gasher's grinning face swam into Roland's mind like the face of a demon or a genie from a bottle. The snaggled teeth, the vacant eyes, the mandrus crawling over the cheeks and spreading beneath the stubbly lines of the jaws. "If you hurt him," he thought, and then forced his mind away, because that line of thought was a blind alley. If Gasher hurt the boy, Jake, his mind insisted fiercely, not just the boy, but Jake, Jake! Roland would kill him, yes. But the act would mean nothing, for Gasher was a dead man already. The gunslinger lengthened the straps of the pack, marveling at the clever buckles which made this possible, slipped it onto his own back, and stood up again. Oi turned to be off, but Roland called his name, and the bumbler looked back. "To me, Oi." Roland didn't know if the bumbler could understand, or if he would obey even if he did, but it would be better, safer, if he stayed close. Where there was one booby trap, there were apt to be more. Next time, Oi might not be so lucky. "Ache!" Oi barked, not moving. The bark was assertive, but Roland thought he saw more of the truth about how Oi felt in his eyes. They were dark with fear. "Yes, but it's dangerous," Roland said. "To me, Oi." Back the way they had come, there was a thud as something heavy fell, probably dislodged by the punishing vibration of the drums. Roland could now see speaker poles here and there, poking out of the wreckage like strange, long-necked animals. Oi trotted back to him and looked up, panting. "Stay close."
"Ake! Ake! Ake!"
"Yes, Jake." He began to run again, and Oi ran beside him, heeling as neatly as any dog Roland had ever seen.